has not happened. So let's talk about that. There have been some significant changes in December coming out of the administration, including more releases. Can you talk
about that? I mean, what we've actually had for many years now is it's virtually nothing happening when it comes to Guantanamo. And that was essentially because Congress imposed, pretty onerous restrictions on the president's ability to release prisoners. He had to jump through a lot of hoops and certify that if prisoners were released, they weren't going to be able to engage in any activities against U.S. interests. But the president always retained a waiver in the legislation that would have enabled him to bypass Congress if he regarded it as being in the national security interest of the United States, which it clearly is, and he has said this. But, you know, in the political calculations that were made, it simply wasn't significant enough for the president to enrage Republicans by expending political capital on Guantanamo. So this went on, you know, for 3 years, essentially. Just five men were released from Guantanamo in 3 years. And then last year, the prisoners themselves really forced Guantanamo back onto the agenda.
And that's a really important point you're making there, Andy. I think that gets ignored in the mainstream press, which is that the hunger strike that had as many, I believe, according to the Miami Herald, as 102 participants at one time and still may have around 30, that is really what forced the administration to respond because the international outrage grew.
That's absolutely right, yes. And what a dreadful way for the president to confront the necessity to do something about it, you know, through these men, you know, genuinely endangering their lives through this prison-wide and very severe hunger strike. It was that provoked him. In May, he delivered a major speech in which he promised to resume releasing prisoners. He promised to appoint two envoys, one in the Pentagon and one in the State Department, to help with the release of prisoners and ultimately to close the prison. And he also, importantly, dropped a ban on releasing Yemeni prisoners, which he had imposed 4 years ago, when there had been a failed bomb plot in which a man had tried to blow up a bomb in his underwear on a plane bound for Detroit. He was a Nigerian man, but he had apparently been recruited in Yemen. And the backlash against this was such that President Obama imposed a ban on releasing any Yemeni prisoners, even though of the 155 men still held, 76 were cleared for release by a high-level task force that he appointed when he took office. And of those 76, 55 of them are Yemenis.
So this is significant, isn't it?
A significant number of people who aren't allowed to go home simply because of their nationality.
And his taking the ban off is significant then. It means that somewhere there in the State Department and in the administration, they're saying there may be some way to repatriate Yemenis.
Well, certainly. And I mean, you know, and also what happened is that there was a significant effort by senior Democrats to work on Congress and with Congress over the last few months to implement new legislation that made it less difficult for the president to release prisoners. And that's also quite significant because Congress has been pretty implacably opposed to the release of prisoners to Yemen as well. Now, you know, what we're waiting for, obviously, is some action where the president decides that he's going to put a bunch of these poor guys on a plane and send them home and not really obsess too much about the fact that some of them might be rather upset about what happened to them. You know, clearly, the big problem here is that a high-level U.S. government program assessed their cases 4 to 5 years ago, decided that the U.S. didn't want to put them on trial or carry on holding them, and yet the United States has blithely carried on holding them. That's, you know, that's so disgraceful that it's something that I think dictators would be embarrassed by. The nerve of saying that there's a process to assess that that you can leave and then not releasing you. So it really does need to be tackled.
Yes, and I think that that's one of the arguments that the administration has been facing. So there may be some headway made in having the release of Yemenis. There also, though, have been some changes that have not been so good. One of those has been less transparency about what's happening inside Guantanamo. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the major one that affects the way that we learn about what's happening at Guantanamo is that the military is no longer letting us know how many people are on a hunger strike. Now, you know, all through the spring and summer, they were reporting, you know, these really quite serious numbers of people who were engaged in the hunger strike and doing that on a daily basis. The hunger strike then kind of wound down, or certainly was severely reduced in the numbers of people taking part. And then the military has stopped reporting it. Now, you know, we've heard from Shaka Armour, the last British resident in the prison, that actually that there are now more people engaged in the hunger strike again. And that certainly I have no reason to presume that they would all be sitting back and going, everything's under control, because, you know, we've had 11 prisoners released in the last few months, but there are still a vast number of people in Guantanamo, everyone else in Guantanamo almost, either is waiting to be released and still not knowing when that's going to happen, or they're people who appear to have been completely abandoned by any notion of justice.
Well,
so
one
there's
of the
no
thing-
reason for them to be, you know, sitting there in any content manner thinking that things have been resolved. And I would imagine that a hunger strike, you know, will again be a way that they will try and focus attention on themselves.
Well, and as we go forward, I do expect that the administration is planning more releases. Is that also your assessment, that there will be more releases coming? And
well, absolutely, Linda. I mean, the thing is that when, you know, we're now down to, you know, having just 21 prisoners from countries other than Yemen who have been cleared for release. So,
and the other, let's talk just a moment, and the others that have not been cleared for release, wasn't there a move recently as well to make it, to do a new review of them to see
well,
whether they can be released?
Again, this is one of the secrecy issues that you mentioned, is that they, basically, when the task force in 2010, January 2010, issued its report on what President Obama should do with all the men who were still held, they recommended at the time that 48 of the men who were still held should continue to be held without charge or trial on the basis that they were too dangerous to release, but that insufficient evidence existed to put them on trial. Now, that obviously makes that evidence extremely dubious, because if you can't use it, then who is to assure us that it's actually credible? But the president promised to assuage critics like me, and obviously human rights organizations and lawyers were up in arms about this. This was Obama himself personally enshrining indefinite detention without charge or trial as an issue, not just something he'd inherited from Bush. So he promised that he would institute these periodic reviews of the men's cases. And shamefully, although he made this promise in March 2011, the first one of these reviews didn't take place until December. So nearly 3 years elapsed before before these indefinitely detained men got the opportunity to ask if possibly the United States might want to reconsider its opinion. We don't know anything about what happened beyond the fact that there was a six-hour session in which the prisoner, accompanied by his lawyer, spoke from Guantanamo to a collection of people from the military and the intelligence agencies who make up the review boards. We don't know when or if a partial transcript is going to be released of what took place. So I think that's another one of the...
So secret court so far.
No problem.
Secret court, secret testimony, secret provisions.
Yeah.
So not so much progress, though I'm sure that the men released are happy with that progress. The National Defense Authorization Act that was signed, that included some changes to how Guantanamo is handled, including the changes that allow the president to transfer people out of the country more easily than before, but they still refuse to allow any of the prisoners to be transferred to the United States, even for trial.
Yeah.
And that is also a significant downturn, because it makes the closure of Guantanamo more difficult. However, I will say I have not a lot of confidence that if they transferred prisoners to the United States, that they wouldn't just end up in one of the CMUs or special solitary confinement units in Terre Haute or in Marion, Illinois, where over 72% or two-thirds of the prisoners are Muslims, and these are solitary confinement centers, so they're very harsh. That's
well,
one of the concerns
I
we should have.
I agree with you more about those places and about the disproportionate punishment of Muslims who come into contact with the criminal justice system on the U.S. mainland. However, I do think that the main issue would be that, you know, although it's very easy to see how broken the justice system is in so many ways with convictions that shouldn't have taken place, these men have been through a process in which they have been tried and convicted. Moving prisoners from Guantanamo to the U.S. mainland would put them in a position of being the only people on the U.S. mainland deprived of their liberty for this huge period without having gone through any form of due process. And I think that would enable new legal challenges to take place. I mean,
very good point.
We are still a long way from that happening. I can't see that Guantanamo can be closed without those men being moved. But as you say, you know, this was not something that survived in this year's NDAA, even though it was something that was proposed. So the Senate had actually been pushing for this, and of course it ran up against problems in the House. And when the Senate and the House met together to thrash out the final version of the legislation, then the compromise that was required was that any mention of transferring people to the U.S. would be dropped in exchange for it being easier for President Obama to release prisoners.
Yes.
I would say, you know, in the most hopeful way of looking at this is that he releases dozens of prisoners this year. And over the course of this year, we're moving much closer to the next stage of the argument, which, you know, is to say to these people who clearly have a, you know, some distorted sense of believing that Guantanamo is acceptable under any circumstances, to say to them it's not. You know, the prison must close. We cannot be seen to condone and endorse and continue a facility where essentially people are detained indefinitely without charge or trial. That's completely unacceptable for a country that claims to respect the rule of law and any kind of decent values.
I agree with you. This is Linda Olsen-Osterlund for KBOO in A Deeper Look, and I'm speaking with Andy Worthington, journalist and author of The Guantanamo Files. About Guantanamo, it is today on the 12th anniversary. I hate to call it anniversary. I think of anniversaries as celebrations, but really it is the 12th year since Guantanamo opened on January 11th. You know, this prison has really revealed, I think, a lot to those in the United States who are paying attention and who want to know how low our government will go when it uses the excuse of national security, because I think there can be no one who doesn't really know that these men are not maybe a handful would be any danger to the United States and never were. So I think all progress we make in restoring constitutional rights and human rights to them is important as we go forward as a nation and in the world.
Yeah, absolutely, Linda, yeah. I question, you know, I don't know what the exact breakdown is of people who are misinformed, people who are cheerleaders for what, you know, the Bush administration's response to 9/11, and the number of people who understand what's going on. Clearly, millions, tens of millions of Americans understand that, you know, what they were told by the Bush administration was not true. But to this day, I think that a lot of people have accepted that their government tells them, we're keeping you safe, don't bother asking too many questions, there's a bunch of bad guys that we kept in some remote prison in Cuba. It's all for the best.
Please, well, not long ago, an anchor from one of the major stations, I believe it was ABC, but I'm not sure, you know, was touring Guantanamo, and I believe it was Shaker Amir called out to her, don't shine your cameras on us. You lock us up and leave us here. And she later said on air, you know, well, I always knew. And then she goes, well, I assumed that they were all bad guys. And it was really interesting to see a news anchor of her supposed stature so really ignorant and willfully.
You know, you could see on her face she was surprised that somebody in an articulate manner was speaking English from behind this solid door. And, you know, she hadn't come across the story of Shaka Amer. Now, you know, you and I know, Linda, and I'm sure many of your listeners do, that a cursory glance at what's actually happening at Guantanamo and who's held there would reveal that there is this vocal and articulate British prisoner.
So,
she hadn't really done much homework.
And I think it was good that we saw her shock, because she was shaken by what he said, that there was someone there who would say, hey, what are you doing poking your camera at us through here? You lock us up indefinitely. You won't let us out. Leave us alone, basically. And I think she had never thought, oh, there's a human being in there who's going to have some kind of response to what we're doing to them. I found that very interesting, but it also worrisome because, unfortunately, a lot of the news that people do get is not from sources that are thoughtful and go underneath the surface about it. I think as we go forward, though, let's talk about that makes all the more reason for the activities to close Guantanamo. I know you're part of a website, part of starting a website called Close Guantanamo. Can you talk about the activities that are going to be taking place January 11th today and in this upcoming week around getting Guantanamo closed?
Well, sure. I mean, the main thing is that every year a coalition of groups that involves, you know, my organization, Close Guantanamo, and Amnesty International, Center for Constitutional Rights, Witness Against Torture, Well Can't Wait, and other groups. You know, we gather in Washington, D.C. We have an event outside the White House where we address the President Obama with the issues that he needs to think about, and we hope that the media will pay attention to what we're doing. And also, you know, I'm over for a couple of weeks this time, Linda, which is, you know, an improvement on last year when it was really difficult to get interest and people were very demoralized before the prisoners, you know, brought it back on, into the headlines through the hunger strike. So this year, clearly there is much more interest. I mean, one of the very positive things for people's engagement is that over the last year, you know, a million people bothered to sign petitions calling for the closure of Guantanamo.
That's fantastic. A million people is not insignificant.
No, absolutely not. And so, you know, I'm over doing events in New York City and in other events in Washington, as well as the January 11th event.
You'll be on the West Coast as well.
San Francisco and Los Angeles, a variety of events, some of them at universities. Some of them with other people who are knowledgeable about Guantanamo, so Jason Leopold and Jeffrey Kay, Michael Kearns, who was part of the SEER program, Todd Pierce, who was a military attorney at Guantanamo, and just, you know, trying to get the word out.
Now, if people want to find out where you're going to be and what days, they can go to either closeguantanamo.org, or you can just, I know if you can put Close Guantanamo into Google, you can be brought to that site, or to andyworthington.co.uk.
Yeah, that's right.
And your schedule will be there and allow people to find out what you're talking about. I think that I've found it heartening that despite the number of years that this struggle has been going on and the amazing amount of difficult situations and events taking place in the world, if we even just turn our head towards the environment, let's say, anywhere else. Look at drones.
Yeah, yeah.
Look at, you know, we just opened 3 test drone areas here in Oregon. So there's so many issues coming at us that I feel heartened that Close Guantanamo movement continues to exist and I think in some ways grows because I see more events locally here. You've spoken twice here, I believe, at local events via video. And many of our listeners may have gotten a chance to see you on that. So I feel heartened that there are activities going on like that all over the country. I know different small groups here in Portland have taken different individual prisoners and are sending them books and interacting with their attorneys on their behalf. I think almost anything anyone can do to enlighten people about Guantanamo is important.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, because although it's, you know, it always should be harrowing that, you know, these are men who, you know, they may be from a different culture, but, you know, we have to look at their victimization for the most part of people given no rights, given no processes that we would expect if we were to be deprived of our liberty. You know, so on a human level, it's very good that people engage and get beyond that powerful but terrible rhetoric of the worst of the worst, which the Bush administration used so cynically, I think. But it is fundamentally those principles. If we allow our governments to detain people without having to explain why, and, you know, when we look in Congress and look at the people in the Senate and the House of Representatives who are cheerleaders for Guantanamo, who come up with all the with all the bombastic rhetoric about terrorism, what we're actually looking at is people who like the ability to deprive people of their liberty without having to explain why.
And that was one of the biggest battles.
All of us.
That was one of the biggest battles over this most recent NDAA authorization and provisions, that the administration had come out once again saying that they do not want indefinite detention and that they do not want that the administration wants indefinite detention. I mean, the people who were helping write the bill were saying, we don't want indefinite detention. We really want to stop. But the biggest pushback against changing that came from both the administration and the military. They seemed intent on maintaining this kind of detention without any end. And I believe that Obama even said in a statement that it was his, that the Congress couldn't even intervene on his right to do that.
Well, you know, I do generally think that the Obama administration would like to reach a point where they're not saying, we're stuck here indefinitely detaining people without charge or trial, and we think this is a great thing. I think they've always treated it more as a difficult legacy from the fact that Guantanamo involves people who nobody really knew who they were. So, you know, everything about the supposed evidence is so difficult to work out what's correct and what isn't. Having said that, there is a kind of area of national security issues, and there are a significant number of players in this, you know, some of them funded lavishly by right-wing think tanks, but, you know, in academia in general and in the whole national security group of people where, you know, obviously lots of people are involved in this, who believe that, you know, that there is a problem with the United States' ability to deprive people of their liberty, that it's not sufficient that you hold people as prisoners of war or that they commit a criminal offense and you therefore charge them and prosecute them in a court of law.
But Andy, wasn't
these
this...
people are fundamentally wrong, Linda, but, yes. You know, they keep banging away saying, no, you don't understand. We have to have some method whereby we can essentially, you know, imprison people indefinitely on a secret basis. I mean, you mentioned secrecy earlier on, and that's very key to it all, I think. And there really is no excuse for it.
Well, and I think that the problem with that is that the original reason that sort of got floated out there for indefinite detention without a trial is because we couldn't bring them to trial because we had tortured them, basically.
Right.
The administration wouldn't say that, but they couldn't bring any evidence because the evidence had been gained illegally via torture. I don't see any other argument that would justify that, and even that is, you know, it turns the world upside down that would be a justification for changing law so that we can hold people forever, so that we can mistreat them.
Yeah, well, no, absolutely. I mean, I agree. And I think, you know, I think if people are saying, well, no, what we're going to have is we're going to have, you know, the intelligence agencies and the security apparatus are going to come up with information that is incriminating but that we can't actually back up with solid evidence. I think we have to constantly say you need to be able to back things up with evidence.
Yeah.
If you can't, we're in a very dangerous place. If we're supposed to trust you, that you know, that your reasoning, that why we have to trust your intelligence is such that people are deprived of their liberty.
Because, I do,
you know,
think
no
that
to the intelligence apparatus of the United States, parts of which I'm sure have been doing a great job. But the last 12 years shows us that, you know, that in many fundamental ways, such as identifying who was at Guantanamo, such as identifying who is dying in drone attacks, such as, you know, justifications for invading a sovereign country, Iraq, over and over and over again, we can't trust our intelligence.
Well, that's what I wanted to say. If nothing else, Edward Snowden has showed us how frequently we've been lied to by our own government. And even in response to his the things that have been revealed through WikiLeaks and through Edward Snowden, they have lied repeatedly about those and then had to take back their lies just in the last many months. So I do believe sometimes it takes a willfulness on the part of Americans to want to believe that their government is not dishonest to them and would tell them the truth about these prisoners. But I'll leave that up to the public to continue to learn the duplicity of their government. Andy, let's talk about this progress, though, that took place. We've only got a couple more minutes, and it does seem like there is progress taking place. And it does seem like we will learn things as each release comes. We learn who the government's actually actually negotiating with and what kinds of opportunities they're seeking for people to be released. And the Uyghurs recently went to several different locations or three different locations, but apparently had some say-so in that. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, there has been a point of not wishing to force people to return to places where they have a fear that they will be severely mistreated. And, you know, the United States has recognized that. The Uyghurs, who are these 22 Muslims from China's Xinjiang province, who were, you know, not caught up in any kind of terrorism or military activity and were just caught by mistake. It was clear, even under Bush, that they couldn't be returned to the Chinese government. And so, you know, they were the first people for whom new countries were sought who would be able to take them instead. I know, you know, what was coming out of the administration is a certain aggressive stance regarding, you know, not wanting to be held up by people making complaints about where they're going to be sent to. But that's particularly centered on Algeria. And, you know, I do understand that the administration, you know, is pushing to get people out. They just need to make sure that they don't cross dangerous lines. So and with the last of the Uyghurs, you know, they found a new home for these guys in Slovakia, which is, I think, is a good sign, because in the first year or so of Obama's presidency, we were seeing people being rehoused in many different countries. And now it appears that we're, you know, going to get into another phase of that, which is very much needed.
Well, I'm looking forward to the first Yemenis to be sent home as well.
Oh, absolutely, me too.
Well, you know, we're out of time once again, and I want to thank you, Andy Worthington of the Guantanamo Files, author of that, UK journalist and activist. He will be in the United States for the next 2 weeks. Please do go to his website, andyworthington.co.uk, or to just put Close Guantanamo in and get to the Close Guantanamo site. Or you can go to World Can't Wait to get a schedule of events that's taking place. I want to thank you again for joining us today, Andy.
Thank you very much, Linda. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
And thank you again. And I want to thank all of you in the audience. Please do take action on behalf of the closer of Guantanamo. It's as easy as clicking a few buttons on your computer if you have that, or writing a letter if you do not. And thanks for tuning in to KBOO, your community radio station.
And good morning. A minute before 10 o'clock, you are listening to The Mighty Boo. We are KBOO Portland. Coming up in 15 minutes, it's Flashpoints. Today, they report on these stories: the CIA's new corporate relationship with the Washington Post, a California court orders Sherwin-Williams, National Lead, and ConAgra to pay $1.15 billion into a fund to remove lead paint from homes, and more protests and calls for justice for Andy Lopez. At 11 today on Between the Covers, the guest is Mona Golubic, concert pianist and author of The Children of Willesden Lane, an account of her mother's ordeal during World War II. And at 11:30 on Words and Pictures, the guest is local artist, writer, musician, and small press mover and shaker, Nicole Georges. Her new funny graphic memoir, Calling Dr. Laura, has drawn rave reviews. But first, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. That's next on KBOO. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. If you are not a member, you can become one by logging in to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate today.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Scanner Foundation's 2014 Martin Luther King Breakfast on Monday, January 20th at 8:30 a.m. at the Oregon Convention Center, 777 Northeast MLK Boulevard in Portland. Each year, the Scanner organizes an inspiring presentation honoring the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and highlights the good work of people making a difference in the community. This year's keynote speaker is Dr. Bruce Goldberg, Oregon Health Authority Director. Again, that's the Scanner Foundation's Martin Luther King Breakfast on January 20th, 8:30 a.m. at the Oregon Convention Center. More information can be found at kboo.fm/MLKBreakfast2014.
morning, Cascadia. Today is Thursday, January 9th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. First, a few headlines. Our guest today, Norman Solomon, we're going to get a little deeper into the... I don't know whether to laugh or cry over this one. Jeff Bezos, Amazon.com, The Washington Post, and the CIA. Does it get any better? I think we've got a musical here, people. Look out, Book of Mormon. Here comes Jeff Bezos and the Book of Amazon. First, the headlines, though. Google, Facebook, Microsoft, and the other tech giants have had to fight for their lives against their own government. Apparently, the word is in the wind that the internet will never be the same. It's the kickoff. That's the kickoff line of Christoph Niemann's lead article. It just came out in Wired on how the NSA almost killed the internet. Yeah, that's a little melodramatic, but he said it. We're reporting it to you, and Wired published it, so there you go. And some things were just not meant to happen. Yesterday, the Port of Portland official said that they would not proceed with developing